I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio. Well, Tim Kaine's trial wrapped up today. The former state treasurer has been accused of corruption during his 2010 run for governor. WGBH's Adam Riley has been following the trial. He's here with me in Studio 3, straight from Suffolk Superior Court. Welcome, Adam.
Hey, Emily.
So, closing arguments. Prosecution went first. That was followed up by the defense, Jeffrey Denner. A couple of interesting tactics on both parts, I thought.
Well, I actually thought it was a pretty rough morning for Tim Kaine. I thought that Kaine's attorney, Jeffrey Denner, struggled the most in his closing. I thought Rankin, the attorney for Scott Campbell, his former campaign aide, did a better job, and I thought the state had the most effective close.
All right, so talk a little bit about how they presented, you know, what arguments they made.
Yeah, well, what I found interesting about Jeffrey Denner's close is that he tried to paint this sort of Horatio Alger-esque picture of Tim Kaine. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, but this is pretty close, you know, his only crime was being a tough kid from Quincy who followed his dreams. And by following his dreams, he meant becoming treasurer, then making a run for governor as an independent.
Didn't he focus on the timeline, saying if he really had intended
to
have these ads help his gubernatorial campaign, he would have launched it much earlier in the season, because by the time they actually did launch, it was too late to save his campaign.
He did make that argument. That was one of the cores of his close. And I think it's actually a pretty good argument, because yeah, I think a lot of us would agree that by the time these ads
started running, which was September, I think.
Yeah, with like, you know, month and a half left in the election, that Kaine really didn't have a prayer. But Denner also kind of stepped on himself a bit as he made that argument, because on the one hand, he said the notion that Kaine ran these ads to benefit his campaign is ludicrous because his campaign was toast when they started running. But on the other hand, he also said, as he spun this sort of Horatio Alger narrative of Tim Kaine as a tough kid from Quincy who followed his dreams, he said Tim Kaine was an incurable optimist and he didn't know when to quit. So if you paint that picture of Tim Kaine, it's not so far-fetched that he would run these ads to try to give himself a boost at a time when everyone else was writing him off.
And then, of course, the state prosecutor, James O'Brien, said that the verbiage in the lottery ads came directly out of campaign focus groups.
Yeah.
Did he have the, you know, comparatives to do that?
We didn't. I think they may have shown that on screen today. Mm. I couldn't see it in court, but that evidence has been presented. And it's pretty damning.
That's damning.
I mean, there were these focus groups in in late July that the campaign assembled so that they could get a sense of how Kaine could proceed in his run for governor. What those campaign focus groups found was that Kaine's stewardship of the lottery was maybe his biggest asset as a candidate. And the day after those campaign focus groups came up with this information, Kaine himself was on the phone with Hill Holiday, which does ads for the lottery, ordering up a new round of lottery spots. And as you mentioned, the timing right there isn't good. And the fact that the verbiage from the ads was drawn directly from the focus group.
But there's nothing illegal about that, about taking the verbiage.
Well, no, there's nothing illegal about taking the verbiage from a campaign focus group and putting it in an ad for your political office. But what you are not allowed to do is, under this new anti-corruption law, is utilize your office to gain a benefit that's not commensurate, not commensurate with your station. And I think that's the contention, that Kaine was effectively taking taking $1.5 million in public money and blatantly, transparently using it not to protect the lottery, but to run for governor. And another problem is the email trail that exists in this case. Again, after these focus groups, emails started going around that included both people from the Treasury and people from the campaign. So right there, you have a broaching of a line that's not supposed, or a breaching of a line that's not supposed to be breached. And in addition, as this email trail continues, you get the distinct sense following it that it's the people from the campaign who are the prime movers who are saying, yes, let's go ahead with these lottery permission spots. Let's get them up on air. That really the campaign has sort of seized control of lottery marketing, and that's definitely a no-no.
So now Scott Campbell, who's being tried along with his attorney in the closing arguments, kind of distanced himself, didn't he?
It was interesting. I actually couldn't tell what his strategy was, if it was to distance himself from Kaine or to argue Kaine's cause. And at times he did both. In terms of the distancing, he talked about how horribly Scott Campbell was treated by Kaine.
Yeah.
He said that Campbell was effectively Kaine's flunky, and that Kaine's treatment of him, he used the phrase, bordered on abuse, which I found incredible. The notion that Kaine was such a tough boss. One problem with that argument actually is, so on the one hand, he said, you know, Scott Campbell wasn't part of this. He was a flunky. He was a go-between. He was a messenger. But on the other hand, that in a way seems to sort of tacitly accept the idea that something illicit was going on. But on the other hand, Campbell's attorney also said there was nothing illegal about what happened here. It's common practice for politicians to use their office in a way that provides political benefit. And he pointed, when he was making that argument, to President Obama's visit to New Jersey after Sandy hit and the appearance with Chris Christie.
Yeah, but he was spending taxpayer dollars, but not really,
dipping
into...
Right. It's different. It's different. The argument that the attorney made was, well, if you got the emails and phone records from Obama's aides, his White House aides, then they would certainly be talking about the political benefit of a trip to New Jersey. I got to say, I'm not sure that that's the case. I think that Obama's aides, no question Obama got political benefit from that.
They wouldn't have to put it in an email.
Is Cahill's great mistake in all of this, is there's sort of a baseline level of simple intelligence beneath which you can't descend when you're a politician. And yes, you're wearing two hats. You're juggling your campaign and you're juggling the office you hold. But Cahill didn't even, based on the evidence that we saw in court in this trial, Cahill and his people made no effort to keep those two separate. They thought, everyone else does this, so we can blend them and be totally overt about it, and it's not going to matter. And it has mattered.
Well, this is the first time anyone's been trialed under these new regulations, which I believe went in 2009, and it's been in effect a while.
All the sort of corruption cases we've had kind of blurred together.
I know. I think it was 2009. Anyway.
You might be right.
Is there an overreach by the government? Because that's one of the kind of accusations. It's, hey, we got to get somebody. We got to send a message. We got to signal this isn't right.
That's an argument that you hear, I think, both legal types and media types talking about in court. If Cahill is convicted, he faces up to 5 years in prison. And some people are sympathetic to him and think that the prosecution has expended way too many resources on this, that he's an easy mark because he left the Democratic Party to run as an independent, that there are corrupt Democrats who Martha Coakley could be pursuing under this new statute who she's not pursuing. It's sort of a matter of taste, I think, of whether you think that the possible misuse of $1.5 million in state money to get political benefit is problematic or not. And I have to say, I'm not intensely sympathetic to Cahill, but I also don't think that the prosecution's case is. It's possible they're overreaching a little bit. I don't see it as grotesque.
Yeah, because reasonable doubt was definitely among the arguments today. Sometimes,
yes.
I mean, that's always a core tenet. But I think today, you were there.
Right. Yeah. No. That
did featured, Denner hammer that?
That featured prominently.
Denner is an odd choice for an attorney in this case.
Why?
I love Jeffrey Denner because he's a criminal lawyer. Mm-hmm. He defends people who murder their wives. I don't know.
Yeah.
He's got like that kind of. I love him, and he's a great guest in it, but he would be an odd choice, I would think. I mean, I would go for some white-collar, federal specialist,
Well, I don't have the familiarity with Denner that you do, but I found his clothes actually to be really strange. This is a complex case. There's a lot of different pieces of evidence to talk about and to rebut if you're in Denner's shoes. And he was sort of going from point A to B to C to E and back to B and back to E. It was very confusing. It wasn't linear. And I'm not an attorney. The jurors, I believe, are not attorneys.
Lay people for the most part.
And you need sort of a linear, clear presentation. He wasn't giving that. And actually, he got a 5-minute warning from Judge Christine Roach. And after she said 5 minutes, Mr. Denner, he said, oh, okay, well, I'm going to jump way ahead now, which seemed like, to indicate that he just wasn't on top of what he was supposed to be saying. At the 1-minute mark,
he should have known exactly where he was.
Yeah, at the 1-minute mark, he was kind of stammering, saying, and then she jumped in to say 1 minute left. So I got the impression watching him that he had just lost the thread a little bit. I'm not sure if he had notes. Good question. But he seemed to lose the argument he wanted to make.
Yeah. So, I always hate to put you on the spot here. What you get? I mean, is the jury actually getting it this afternoon, or are they just being charged and all that?
I left when the charge was still going on. My thought is that they'll begin deliberating today, but I'm not 100% sure about that. If I had to predict, I would predict that Cahill will be convicted here. I think that he hurt himself, among other things, by sort of saying that he had no inkling that what he did in this case could be considered problematic. And the state's prosecutor, James O'Brien, made a big point of focusing on that today. He said, Tim Cahill took the stand and under oath, said that it never occurred to him, not once, that these lottery ads could benefit his run for governor. And James O'Brien, the prosecutor, said, It'd be a lot more believable if he said, yeah, it occurred to me, but I decided it was the right thing to do anyway. Yeah. And I think Cahill, in his defense, may himself have overreached a little bit, and I think that's going to hurt him.
I mean, there's a fair amount of leeway here with the government's punishment for this crime. I mean, he could get 5 years. He could get nothing. He could get a substantial fine or something like that.
I'd split the difference. I'd say he's going to get, you know, two and a half years.
You actually think he's going to go to jail?
That is my hunch. That is my hunch. But I've made
many predictions. The federal government does not mess around when it comes to white collar crime. We've seen, you know, a couple of really tough sentences for Chuck Turner, and Diane Wilkerson. Although she, you could say, had established a fairly long history of, you know, kind of flying in the face of, you know,
making bad mistakes, ill-advised mistakes. Yeah, and you know, each time you get a big sentence like that, it creates momentum to make the next sentence hefty. And also, when they expend the resources that they've expended on this, and with it being the first big conviction that will be won under this new corruption law, you know, if the law doesn't yield a conviction on its first time out, it's not going to look too good for the people who crafted it, or for Martha Coakley, who pursued this case.
All right, we've been talking about the Tim Cahill trial, which is going to the jury either sometime this afternoon or first thing in the morning. They were just getting charged as Adam Riley was leaving a few minutes ago. Adam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Emily.
And Kara Miller is back.
Hey, Emily. So we're going to be talking about, taking off from Hurricane Sandy, which created devastation all up and down the East Coast. What do we do about global warming as it goes forward?
Do we really think there's more storms? I remember a lot more when I was a kid.
Well, I'm going to talk to the author Charles Mann about it and about how he suggests a little bit of an unorthodox way that we address it.
Okay, I'm Emily Rooney.
And I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio.